Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 696 by my count. My name is Camden Busey. I'm in Grays Lake, Illinois, and I'm delighted to be back today for a really fun conversation, one I've been looking forward to here for several weeks. But let me introduce to you our panel. We have with us in studio, I have a panelist in studio, delighted to have with us, Ryan Noah, who serves as kind of a doer of all things here at Reformed Forum. He's an executive assistant, but also somewhat the director of Reformed Academy. Welcome back to the program, Ryan. It's good to have you.
Thanks so much, Camden. It's great to be in studio in Grays Lake here.
Yeah. I mean, it's a joy to have you here and to connect. And we have two of us here in studio at Grays Lake, but we're also joined by our esteemed guest. This is the first time on the program, Dr. Crawford Gribben, who is professor of the School of History, Anthropology, Philosophy, and Politics at Queen's University in Belfast over in Northern Ireland. Welcome to the program, Dr. Gribben. It's great to see you today.
Thanks, Camden. Thanks for the invitation to be here.
We are honored to have you with us and very much looking forward to this. We're going to be speaking about Dr. Gribben's new book, Survival and Resistance in Evangelical America, Christian Reconstruction in the Pacific Northwest. It's published by Oxford University Press. I just finished it a few days ago. Thoroughly enjoyed it, really, for good portions of it. Couldn't put it down. And I've also listened to a few other interviews that Crawford's done and try to link to some of those in the episode description as well. But coming at it from a different perspective, we're looking forward to this conversation and opening up this important subject, but one I think that at least people within our tradition, the OPC, or even broadly speaking, NAEPARC in North America, or just the conservative confessional community throughout the world, there's an awareness of what's going on with Christian Reconstruction and the history with folks like R.J. Rushdoony and Gary North and others such as Doug Wilson, but perhaps not a full understanding of what they're actually saying or teaching and how things have come to be the way they are and why they seem to be in many ways collating or gathering together in the Pacific Northwest of the United States. So we'll get into all of that today. But before we do so, I've got just a few things to mention. Of course, I always encourage people to visit us online at reformedforum.org. We've got a lot of different offerings there. And since Ryan's here, we'll also promote a Reformed Academy, which is our online educational component. We have a whole host of free courses available. You can take them on demand at your own time. All you need to do is sign up for a free account. Just give us an email address so that you can actually log in, and it will track your progress. But we have courses on covenant theology, Westminster Shorter Catechism, several courses on the apologetics of Van Til, which is certainly going to come into discussion here today as we speak about Christian Reconstruction and the interplay there with figures like Rushdoony and Bonson. We've got a cohort going on. That'll be closed by the time this episode airs, but keep your eyes open for future offerings, all at reformedforum.org/academy. And if you got any questions, you can send us an email and Ryan will pick up. Ryan over here.
Yeah, be mail. happy to talk to you about Reformed Academy. Just mail at reformedforum.org.
You got it. Looking forward to it. So there's a lot of great opportunities, a lot of good things going on here at Reformed Forum, and we're happy to serve. So if you got any questions, email us and let us know. Well, let's open up the book here, Survival and Resistance in Evangelical America. Crawford, certainly this fascinates me, and I'm glad this book is written. No doubt Ryan knows this tradition quite a bit more than I do in this history and is well-read in the primary literature a lot more than I am, has a lot more to say. But at least at first look, it seems, to be honest, it seems like an odd project for an historian from Northern Ireland to undertake. So how were you introduced to this history, and how does it relate to your particular research interests?
Thanks, Camden. Mm-hmm. It's a fair question. What on earth takes someone from Belfast to North Ireland? So, don't we have enough religious nutcases at home? Well, of course we do. but at least when you go elsewhere, you get to meet nicer ones than some of the ones that I might be involved with here. I began working on this project, I suppose, about 25 years ago when I was doing my PhD in Glasgow at University of Strathclyde. And I used to go frequently across the bookshop in Edinburgh, James Dixon Books, which still operates today. Great secondhand bookshop for items of Scottish Reform provenance. Anyway, I literally stumbled over a pile of these Credenda Agenda magazines that were down in their basement. And, you know, this was about maybe 1995, the autumn of 1995. Credenda Agenda had been going for about seven or eight years by that point. And, you know, I took them home. I began to read them. It was quite, you know, an extraordinary experience in many ways. I was spending my days reading Puritan apocalyptic material and my night reading Credenda Agenda. There was this kind of lovely crossover between the two. You know, there's a real kind of continuity between the way in which a lot of my 17th century subjects were thinking about current responsibilities and future prospects. And, I saw the same kinds of themes coming out in Credenda Agenda. And through Credenda Agenda and through other sources in the bookshop, I became interested in reading the work by Gary DeMar initially, then Gary North, eventually to Rush Dooney, once I realised that Rush Dooney was not some kind of drug, but actually a writer with some interesting things to say. And over the course of time, you know, just kept thinking about some of the things that were going on coming out of North Idaho, watched the community that Doug Wilson was leading grow, evolve, change its name, become increasingly self-consciously reformed, not least in the stylization of the church's name, moving from Community Evangelical Fellowship to Christkirk sometime around, I think, 1998 or 1999. And, you know, kept in touch with some of the things that were being published, especially in issues like infant baptism, as I was sort of reading my way through some of these controversies that interest us. And I suppose, you know, all of that was going on and that was interesting. But then about 2008, the financial crash came and I became interested in some of the online discussions about survivalist cultures. And especially a website run by a man called James Wesley Rawls, who identified himself then, I think still does, as a Reformed Baptist. And James Wesley Rawls defined this concept of the American Redoubt. So this is a section of Idaho, Montana, Eastern Washington, Eastern Oregon, and so on, that kind of area, which he thought was really ideally placed to be a holdout for traditional Christian values as the rest of American culture began to crumble. So what was really interesting about James Wesley Rawls was that he began to publish novels. And now his novels were initially self-published. Then he began to get really big deals for some of his novels with, you know, really major publishers began to take these on. And what really caught my attention was when in one of these novels, some of the characters actually ended up going to Doug Wilson's church.
Right.
And I think if I remember correctly, one of them was serving as a security detail outside Christ Church, Moscow, Idaho, which is just a fascinating moment of crossover. So I was working in Dublin at that point, which is not in Northern Ireland, Camden. It's in a separate country, just for clarification. So I was working in Dublin at that point with a good friend of mine still, who's from Coeur d'Alene, Scott Spurlock, who teaches theology at Glasgow University. And Scott and I decided that we would love to do a bit of a road trip. But, you know, academics, they don't want to pay for anything themselves.
Of course not.
So we had to turn this into a research project to get funding to pay our way to drive around Eastern Washington and North Idaho, which we did. And it was great fun, enormous fun. And, you know, we had a great time. But we also met some really interesting people, saw some really interesting, sometimes peculiar, sometimes even slightly dangerous things, talking to a really quite a wide range of people who are associated with this movement into the Pacific Northwest. So the really important thing, I think, to realise about this is it's a very decentralised movement. There's no one leader, there's no one place that people gather to. You know, there's a lot of different agendas here, a lot of different aspirations, a lot of different kinds of ambitions. Some people are much more confident about being able to survive the impending crisis than others. All of them want to. All of them have slightly different views for what might come in the aftermath of this crisis. So anyway, there we were driving around, and you know, we spent a really interesting weekend in Moscow, Idaho, in the summer of 2015 with folk from Christkirk, from New St Andrews College and so on. And we had a really interesting chat. The first night we arrived, we went to the bar, which is the only student-friendly bar in Moscow, Idaho, and it's run by someone who goes to Doug Wilson's church. And, you know, I was sipping orange juice. Everyone else was into their kind of heavy-duty stuff, or perhaps not. But, you know, we were sitting there having this conversation, and, we raised the issue of James Wesley Rawls. And were they aware of James Wesley Rawls? And none of the faculty members that we were hanging out with, I think, had heard of him. I think Doug Wilson had heard of him, but none of them were aware of the status of their congregation in this incredibly powerful, incredibly diversified survivalist culture. So that was a really telling moment of disjunction between what I might have thought was the case before I actually got there to see what was going on with Scott, my friend Scott Spurlock. Wow. So, I mean, that was really how it started. Camden, summer 2015, driving around, back again in the summer of 2016, some long-distance telephone call and interviews stretching back, I suppose, to 2013, and then, you know, in the period after that. And, you know, the book that we're talking about is mm-hmm. is the fruit of that very well receipted church trip.
Well, we're thankful that occurred, and we're reaping the fruits of that labor, the benefits of it, and to much great interest and I think personal edification for me. It's caused me to think about a lot of things in terms of the interrelationship of the church and state, just the nature of the United States. There's so many things that have been happening globally, but especially in the United States, you know, thinking of the previous president and the current election, the previous election. There's so many intersection points here to think of how Reconstruction fits into that is phenomenal. You know, one thing you sparked my interest here in terms of we have fiction crossing over into the real world and how some people may not even be aware that they're part of these fictional narratives that are, you know, we're talking millions of copies sold of these books with HarperCollins and other publishers. This is no joke. This is a big deal. It reminds me of this podcast I listened to a long time ago. It might have been Radiolab, talking about this phenomena called kayfabe and its use within professional wrestling. And it finds kind of a historical antecedent with Don Quixote, because you end up with, you know, Miguel de Cervantes writing this book, and then other people started to steal the Don Quixote character and writing their own fan fiction with it. And he didn't like it and started to write in his own official novels reactions to the detractors in the real world. And it's just at some point you start to lose sight of what's real and what isn't. So we got Doug Wilson, the character in the John Wesley Rawls novels, and the church and other figures. And you start to, I can imagine there are some people who think these are historical figures that moved and joined Christ Church, while others, you know, recognize John Wesley Rawls made them up. But I'm curious here, you're joking a bit. We were both joking a bit before in terms of Americans' awareness of anything outside of our own country regarding, you know, Ireland and Northern Ireland and Belfast and Dublin and all that. But people might not even Americans might not understand some of the key features here of the Pacific Northwest. And you mentioned Eastern Washington, Northern Idaho, Eastern Oregon, Montana as well. I'm curious here. Obviously, there's thought to be some strategic advantages to holding up there, given the impending apocalypse, whenever that might happen. But zooming out and bigger picture, I'm curious, with this whole project, as you've studied it, you've done a tremendous amount of work, scholarly work on Puritan apocalyptic thought, millenarianism at the Westminster Assembly, all that sort of thing. But just your general take, and we'll get into the details, but is this a distinctly American phenomenon? And could such a thing as what has been happening in the Pacific Northwest among Christian Reconstructionists, could that sort of thing happen in Northern Ireland or even more generally the United Kingdom?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, Camden. And it's one that we struggled with a lot, Scott and I, as we talked about what we were witnessing as we traveled around. And then as we continue to think about as I was writing this book. It's a difficult question to answer, I think. I think there is something very distinctly American about it. So, you know, there's a lot of narratives in American culture glorifying the West and, you know, frontier life and the simplicity and the authentic American values of life on the edges of civilization. You know, there's a long history of using those kinds of tropes. So I think there is something distinctly American about it. I'm not sure whether we could say there's something uniquely American about it. I think that's a different kind of claim. I think certainly that it would be very difficult for the success of the Moscow Idaho community to be replicated anywhere else. One of the really striking things about fieldwork, and this is back now in 2015, 2016, talking to New St. Andrews graduates or talking to people who are part of the church's community, one of the really striking features of those conversations was their sense that so much of the achievements of that community hung around a tiny handful of individuals. And, you know, I don't talk about this in the book, but in some of those conversations, there was almost a sense of anxiety. So, you know, this community has really quite an extraordinary ambition, you know, and to be fair to this community, it has really made quite extraordinary moves towards realizing large parts of this ambition.
Absolutely.
It wants to make Moscow, Idaho a Christian town. But from that, it really wants to, you know, to see the social religious reconstruction of North America, you know, and to play a part in, you know, what Bavinck might call a great sweep of victory of Christ's kingdom around the earth. So they have really clear ambitions about what they want to achieve. I suppose, though, the question that haunts a lot of that is the question of whether this can be achieved anywhere else, or whether there is something unique about the, if you like, the ecclesiological or sociological ecology of Moscow, Idaho, that makes this much more plausible or much more efficiently realized in that location than it could be anywhere else. So, I mean, you think about what's going on in Moscow. There's two very, very substantial church congregations, the combined membership of which totals around 10% of the town's population. They have a K-12 school, Christian school. They've got a very successful, very high quality liberal arts college. They've got a music conservatory, and they've got a number of very, very key businesses in the locality. So, you know, what that ecology means is that someone from, I don't know, France, England, the Caribbean, can decide to move either with their family or indeed as a student to go to study at New St. Andrews College. Very often, you know, as often happens, but certainly it seems to be the case fairly regularly with the people we spoke to, you know, they meet a potential marriage partner, they decide to get married, they settle down. Why not? Moscow's a beautiful town. They're surrounded by like-minded people. There are friendly workplaces where they can get employment, you know, and all of a sudden it's a virtuous circle of success that can pull people in, that can attract them into something that's very credible, very strong, very clearly articulated, but actually give them the sociological, even economic supports to keep all of this moving forward in a way that's obviously beneficial to the individual, to their family, but to the church community as well. Whether it's beneficial to the wider town environment or to the Moscow Pullman area is obviously something that's contested a lot in the local media. And, you know, for all that people within this community might see this as a really striking example of post-millennial success, we might say, that there are many other people in the community who see this ambition as something that should worry them. And certainly some of the rhetoric that comes out in some of the community's publications is rhetoric that they find very deeply troubling.
Mm. Yeah. Boy, you brought us in there to give us a portrait of what you called perhaps the most post-millennial town in America. And I wonder if you could draw out a bit more for us how classical Christian education in Moscow is an area that you've identified where these reconstructionists have actually begun to reconstruct as opposed to just survive and resist. But they've really positively built something with an ostensibly biblical worldview. How have they flourished and borne fruit according to their own goals of Reconstruction with regard to New St. Andrew's College, Lagos Christian School, etc.?
Great, Ryan. No, great question. I suppose I should just preface my answer with a qualification of some of the things I suppose I've been saying. I don't think Doug Wilson would see himself as a fully fledged Reconstructionist. He's obviously very influenced by Rush Dooney. You know, he's very vocal about that. He doesn't hide it. You know, he writes regularly about Rush Dooney, quotes Rush Dooney regularly in his writing as well. In conversations with Doug one day, he was happier to describe himself as a Reconstructionist 0.5 than as a Reconstructionist 2.0, but still, you know, within the category of Reconstruction, not kind of a fully fledged Gary North Mark II, but as obviously as his own person I think compared to the first generation of Reconstructionists, a much broader set of social goals and cultural goals. So not just political or cultural, but actually not just political and social, but actually social and cultural as well. And obviously, as you said, Ryan, the very successful efforts to reconstruct education in Moscow, initially with the Logos School back in the late 80s, early 90s, and then with the establishment of the Liberal Arts College, New St. Andrews College in the mid-1990s, early to mid-1990s, they have made, I think, very, very powerful, very impressive strides towards realising some of these goals. Now, the Logos School, interestingly, was established before the Christ Church, or as it was then, Community Evangelical Fellowship, was actually a Reformed church. So this was not necessarily an education project driven by explicitly Reconstructionist agendas. In fact, it wasn't even initially driven by explicitly Reformed agendas. It was purely an attempt by a number of local Christian families to provide a more credible worldview Christianity for their covenant children. However, as the leadership team within the community moved increasingly towards embracing Reformed ideas and Reformed values, it took on a much more robustly Reformed view. A lot of this, you know, a lot of the movement towards classical education was driven by some of the folks' interest in an essay by Dorothy Sayers, The Lost Tools of Learning. Mm-hmm. Recovering Lost Tools of Learning, you know, is a big trope in a lot of Doug Wilson's writing in the mid-1990s up to, I suppose, more or less the present day. The Sayers essay that I mentioned had been republished in the National Review back, I think, in the early 80s. I'm not quite sure when, but that was where Doug Wilson sourced the essay, sourced this view of classical Christian education. Obviously, then they reprinted it on whenever they established their own press. We may talk about that later, and began to make this theoretical manifesto, I suppose you might say, a centrepiece for how they thought about Christian education. Now, Reconstructionists in the 1990s were also running a fully-fledged Reconstructionist college, Christ College, down in somewhere in Virginia, I forget exactly where. And, you know, that was being, you know, classes were being taught there by Kenneth Gentry and a number of other familiar names within the Reconstructionist world. But my sense is it was guided much more by the Rush Dooney model of education, which was very, very sceptical of classical values. And you get echoes of this, I think, in some of the writing of Gary North as well. There's a real fear that exposing Christian families' children to the kind of sexual politics, let's say, of Greek and Latin literature, was actually exposing them to harm. Now, in Moscow, Idaho, as the project really began to take off in the 1990s, there was a much more robust view that the Christian worldview could make sense of and indeed critique some of those values while still distilling the potency that they represented in terms of critical thinking and also just cultural literacy, I think, as well. So all of that was going on in Moscow. Then as the Logos School really began to take off, it became one of the flagship schools of at national level of the classical Christian agenda for primary and secondary education. And from that school then, there was established a National Association of Classical Christian Schools, which has grown and grown. You can look at the website. It's incredibly professionally laid out. The speaker, I think, 2 years ago at their national convention was Ben Sass. So, you know, these are not, they're not hiding their light under a bushel. You know, they're out there. There are thousands of families sending their children to these schools. And then, of course, beyond, so that's the Moscow network. But beyond the Moscow network, you've also got lots and lots of other Christian education providers out there, often providing resources for homeschool families, Sunlight, you know, classical conversation. So there's lots of different options out there, isn't there? But it's really interesting. If you go back and look at some of the older Sunlight catalogues, you'll find them also advertising Rush Dooney's work as part of a package for teenage students who might be interested in thinking about how their Christian faith relates to broader social questions. So there's a lot going on here. I think we can see a huge investment in education in the Moscow community, but I think we can also see how lots of these paradigms, lots of these aspirations, these goals, these objectives are being developed nationally and across a whole range of education providers, many of whom may not regard themselves as reformed at all.
That's fascinating to see how Moscow is carried on and in different ways. Rush Dooney's legacy and the intellectual foundation he laid and thinking about all education as inherently religious and his desire to see it be totally divorced from the state, anti-statist, free market. Michael J. McVicker and other scholars like Molly Wharton or Worthen have observed that Rush Dooney, his influence is underappreciated or perhaps underrecognized with regard to politics and government. But you also draw out in your book how influential he was in, as you put it, reorienting American education. I wonder if you could draw us into his influence in that regard.
That's a great question, Ryan. So you mentioned Molly Worthen's book and Michael McVicker's book, both of them excellent. Apostles of Reason by Molly Worthen and then McVicker's biography of Rush Dooney, which is a fascinating, if sometimes also very sad, biographical study. There's two other publications I think that help us with this. One is Julie Ingersoll's book called Christian Reconstruction, came out with Oxford University Press maybe about 3 or 4 years ago. Julie Ingersoll writes as someone who's a religious studies scholar, but as someone who has a family background within Christian Reconstruction. And in fact, if I remember correctly, her husband, her previous husband, her ex-husband, was part of the family that set up Fairfax Christian School in Fairfax, Virginia, which again is one of the early sort of flagship books. And if I remember correctly, her father-in-law wrote the volume on Christian education that was published in Gary North's series Biblical Blueprints.
Which The Children Trap.
Which you probably got three copies of that, Ryan.
I have a few, yeah.
Yeah, good. and of course, you put them along in your thing, in your shelf, they all map out a complete global
map,
don't they?
That's right.
So there's that. So there's that background. But then there's also a guy called Milton Geithner. And Milton Geithner has written a book called Homeschool. I forget the subtitle, but it's a history of American homeschooling. And in a second edition, which came out about 2 years ago from Palgrave Macmillan Publishers, he really expanded his discussion of Rush Dooney to show how central Rush Dooney was to families in Texas, for example, and many other states, obtaining the legal right to homeschool their children. So, you know, people have various views of Rush Dooney, some of them less well-informed than others.
Right.
But one of the ways I think we need to think about Rush Dooney is as a legal reformer who really spent years of his life flying around the country to give expert witness in a number of sometimes very, very important, key, strategic court cases in which families were under pressure to, you know, give their children to state education systems. And Rush Dooney made the argument, which you've just rehearsed, Ryan, that that education is inherently religious. It's about foundational values. It's not something that's just tacked on. It's not pragmatic. It's about principles. And therefore, a family's right to educate their children in their own faith must be a key component of religious liberty in terms of the Constitution. So, you know, Rushdoony gives himself to that, and I think that's probably his greatest success, you know, as you review his lifetime of achievement. The fact that today there may be 3 million American children provided with a homeschool education is largely thanks to R.J. Rushdoony. Now, we can talk about R.J. Rushdoony in very, you know, other contexts as well, some of them not nearly as happy as that. But I think that's a very important thing that we need to take away from his achievements. So Reconstruction has always been about education. Rushdoony pushed for it, worked for it, but really I think it's the folk in Moscow, Idaho, who've really taken that vision and done most with it. But absolutely, I think, building upon the foundations that Rushdoony laid.
Mm. That, you know, I would like to dig down into Rushdoony more and back up maybe to the 60s, but then leading into the 70s, I think perhaps at least one interesting entree other than education to speak about Rushdoony might be Christian Reconstruction's relationship to general or broader evangelicalism. And I'd love for you to comment on this or just to open up some of the themes that you address in the book regarding Christian Reconstruction's relation to the general trends that we see among evangelicalism in the 70s and 80s, and particularly with the religious right and, you know, what was known at the time among many as the moral majority.
Yeah. Yeah, well, of course, the moral majority was never the majority it was thought to be, was it?
And that's the evangelicals' problem, isn't it? They always round up too much, I think.
Absolutely. Round numbers. I mean, I think Rushdoony would never have been fooled by that. I think Rushdoony was pretty clear that the number of people who were prepared to endorse what had to be done to live faithfully, for the church to live faithfully, was always going to be a remnant. You know, and you know, the language of the remnant is language that floats through his writing in I think, very considerable degrees. I think it's an interesting question, Camden, the question about how influential Reconstruction ideas were on broader evangelicalism. In a way, we could say hardly influential at all, because, you know, the story of 1970s into the 1980s, the Christian Coalition moral majority, that story is the story of an attempted power grab.
Yeah, right.
A top-down effort at national reformation. We get our man into the White House, Pat Robertson, or wherever it's going to be, you know, and he'll do what we want. So, you know, they get, you know, 76, Jimmy Carter outs himself as an evangelical, raises lots of completely unfounded expectations as to what he's going to do, for example, about Roe v. Wade. Then they transfer their, you know, all of their utopian, almost millennial hopes into Ronald Reagan. What happens? The same thing all over again, different party, but the same kind of political experience. So, you know, all of these efforts to achieve Christian Reformation through top-down implementation of power fails again, again, and again. Meanwhile, you've got Rushdoony, Chalcedon Foundation, toiling away quietly in California, you know, producing rafts of publications. Gary North doing the same. You know, little communities springing up, collapsing, all over different parts of especially the southern states. But some of their ideas then begin to creep out and to permeate into some really unusual places. Now, Julie Ingersoll, in her book Christian Reconstruction, writes about this, I think, really well. And she describes how, you know, in some of the lobbying organizations in Washington, you know, there are shelves of Reconstructionist books sitting there ready to be used. I remember back in the late 1990s, when I was, you know, collecting a lot of this material, I found in another secondhand bookshop in Scotland a copy of one of Gary North's books about economics, which had inside it a bookplate that said it had belonged, or perhaps even maybe it still did belong, to the Royal Bank of Scotland. I've no idea how books get in, you know, a bank collection, yeah, into a secondhand bookshop. But anyway, you know, there it was, and I've still got it. So, you know, Gary North's books you know, in the Royal Bank of Scotland, other books and lobbying organisations. But really, you know, Reconstructionist ideas do begin to make an impact on evangelicalism through Francis Schaeffer. And Francis Schaeffer has a relationship with R.J. Rusduni's work that is difficult to be precise about. But there is certainly, I mean, there are certainly chunks of Rusduni that appear in Schaeffer's work, thematically very, very similar. Let's put it that way. Perhaps other kinds of similarities as well. Now, in some ways, that's ironic because Schaeffer wasn't post-millennial; he was pre-millennial, and than Rusduni ever was. Rusduni, in his Christian Manifesto, the need for Christian citizens to resist the state from time to time. Rusduni doesn't go down that route at all. He's much more interested in retreating in order to survive, instead of trying to conquer America by military force. And, you know, I suppose one thing you could say that Rusduni was trying to teach American evangelicals that they might not have been listening to was that the transformation of the individual through regeneration has to come before the transformation of families, of localities, of counties, of states, and then ultimately federal government itself. But the Reconstructionist vision is very much bottom up in the 80s. I think probably also to the present.
Rusduni, I'm wondering if you might be able to speak with us a bit about his own personal biography in terms of his family history from where he came, and also maybe some of his early works, because in many regards, we have a book here behind Ryan down in the corner here, By What Standard? And he was in many ways an early interpreter of Cornelius Van Til, and he had a pretty close relationship with Van Til early on. And then once he got into more political territory, Van Til somewhat distanced from Rush, as he's called in the letters. But it's interesting to see and important, I think, to recognize RJR's influence early on, especially because it might not be understood so many by, especially by Van Tilians, how important Rush was in those late 60s years and early 70s.
I think that's a fascinating question, Camden. If listeners want to follow this up, Michael J. McVicker's book is really good on this. Mm-hmm. But to think about your question, Rusduni comes from an Armenian family. Not an Arminian family, an right. Armenian family. But his parents had been survivors of the Armenian genocide. And, you know, they had moved. His father, I think, actually studied at New College, Edinburgh, and was ordained in the Church of Scotland. And that's the kind of Presbyterian background that R.J. Rusduni came from. His father then moved to America, I think was a PCUSA minister, and that was Rushduni's own background. But Rusduni, R.J. Rusduni, was determined that the fate that had happened to Armenian Christians should never occur within America, that American Christians had to be equipped intellectually, theologically, and also pastorally to anticipate a great crisis that was going to come their way. And I think, you know, R.J. Rusduni gets a lot of negative press, and I'm not saying that's not deserved, that there are parts of his work that are certainly not what we would want to be identified with at all. But he is, I think, a prophetic figure in that he can see more clearly than almost anyone else that I've read in the 60s what the path of American society and culture is going to be through the succeeding decades. And of course, the reason why he can become such an acute prophet, I mean, to use that kind of language, such an acute observer of the trends within American society and the direction of American society, is because he's applying Cornelius Van Til's basic concepts to his reading of American culture.
Yeah.
So Rusduni is very, very clear. As the decades roll towards the 20th century, Americans, given their various backgrounds, are going to become more true to themselves. They're going to resolve lots of the inner contradictions by being more simply who they actually are. Now, Van Til, as you know, has got a whole language for describing that that I'm not equipped to even engage with.
Right.
But Rushdoony uses Van Til as a tool to make those kinds of prognostications. And of course, you know, they are right. Yes, as Rushdoony became more orientated towards social reconstruction, that whole agenda, Van Til does seem to get very uncomfortable with some of the direction that he's going in. But Rushdoony, I think, might have been one of the first to publish a study of Van Til's thought back in, was it the late 1950s? I can't quite remember.
Yeah, 1958.
Oh, is that early?
58, yeah. By what standard came up?
Oh, I thought that was in the 60s. So
it's really early.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's so much. I mean, we're discussing history today, and there are no doubt going to be many listeners who, you know, maybe even yelling at their car speakers at the moment, or they're out for a run and they're wishing that we would address, you know, some deeper issues regarding the critique of theonomy and Christian Reconstruction. That's not our task today. I just want to say that out loud. We can do that at a later program. We're discussing the history, and this is more from an historical and a sociological and even to a degree political perspective. Just to make a comment, though, regarding Van Til's connection to theonomy, it's my personal position, and as well as shared by a lot of other Van Tilian scholars, that Christian Reconstructionism often misses the profound influence of Gerhardus Voss upon Cornelius Van Til, which leads them into some other, you know, developments, theological and political and social, that made Van Til a bit uncomfortable, which is borne out in his letters. But that's for another day, perhaps a different discussion where we can pick that strand up. Ryan, you can comment on that if you want, whether you agree or disagree.
I mean, I suppose I'll leave it at this. I agree with Bonson that I won't give up that Van Til had the spirit of Reconstruction, even if he didn't go all the way there with his flying high, the banner of pro reggae with Kuiper. And we were just talking about the other day, Charles G. Dennison and the history of the OPC and the influence of Van Til. And I think the direction that we've gone here at Reform Forum has been more with the pilgrim ethic,
of course,
and mentality. Yeah. But he does recognize that Van Til did have that that great desire to seize culture for Jesus Christ and to assert his total lordship over all things in heaven and on earth. So it's a bigger discussion and a
it
good
is.
One to
and,
have.
And even that, will mean, you know, Van Til's relation to Kuiper is demanding a dissertation of its own, I think. And that a lot of his writings on that, neo-Kuiperianism, neo-Calvinism, makes people uncomfortable, especially, you know, people much more in the pilgrim camp, for lack of a better word, which I find myself in. Nevertheless, there's a lot to be explored. Crawford, speaking, I love the way you divide the chapters up in this book. And it's just very well constructed. And of course, it's very well written. So I appreciate what you've done. And, you know, we're not going to have time perhaps to get into all the details that I would like to at the moment. We might be able to have a round two at some point. But there's an entire chapter on migration. And I think that's really an important place to begin. It's one of the early chapters in the book. You already mentioned John Wesley Rawls, and we've talked a bit about the survival streak in the Pacific Northwest. I suppose I'm interested if you might expand upon that, if there are any other reasons for that particular geographic location of the United States to attract certain people, and perhaps even why has the community in Moscow, Idaho, begun in Moscow, Idaho? Is it incidental? Do you find any innate features of the landscape or the culture in that area that might make it more fertile ground for such movements? Because I wouldn't mind. I'm kind of half joking, but I'm not really. I'm open to moving to southeastern or perhaps even, you know, Midwest or Mid-Northern Michigan. If anyone wants to invite me to maybe move there, has a homestead for me or something like that, I'd be there as long as I could get to a good library in 45 minutes. So I'll just leave that open. But if you're going to tell me that it wouldn't work in Michigan, then I'll just give up my dream.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. There's a very well-known Presbyterian author called Louis Theroux. No, Louis Theroux is a satirical documentary maker.
Yeah.
And He did this documentary where he went to North Idaho and visited some of the sort of semi-survivalist communities in that area. And he sat down with a man called Bo Gritz, or Bo Greets, as sometimes he's known, who's a kind of a Vietnam vet, did a lot of work trying to find MIA POWs after Vietnam, was a Constitution Party presidential candidate and so on. But anyway, Louis Theroux meets Bo Gritz, and Bo Gritz lays out this map of the Pacific Northwest, and he gets a great big permanent marker, and he shows that the lines of nuclear drift that might go across the North American continent.
Right.
You know, he points out that the closer you are to the coast, the more you might experience a big, big flood. And anyway, you know, by a process of elimination, scribbling all around the map, he leaves this tiny frame empty, and that's, you know, that's what's now the American Redoubt. So the American Redoubt has been calling people for a long, long time. You know, it's part of the whole Western myth, isn't it? Of, you know, utopian communities often set up on the boundaries of the American experience in different kinds of ways. But what is it that really generated this community's foundation in Moscow, Idaho? Well, I think actually the answer is a lot more pragmatic than any of these things. And that is, back in the 1970s, Jim Wilson, who's Doug Wilson's father, was I think, if I remember correctly, was running a series of evangelistic bookshops, and he was looking for the best towns, the best locations to put these bookshops in. And you know, I think famously within the Moscow, Idaho world, he had two criteria for identifying where he would want to have an evangelistic bookshop based, and he said that the two criteria were the town should be strategic and achievable. So, you know, any major city is strategic, but, you know, Chicago is not achievable. Any small town is achievable, but not every small town is strategic.
Yeah.
So he looked at the Moscow-Pullman area on either side of the Washington-Idaho border. He realized there's two, you know, it's a small community, 20,000 people, but it's got two major universities. You know, and he quickly came to the conclusion that was an area where you know, a relatively small number of Christian families could make a strategically significant impact for the kingdom, and you know, that's what happened. The family moved there. They began to, you know, form the nucleus of a church. Doug Wilson took over, and gradually it began to expand. But I think fundamentally that's what allowed the group to begin in that area. What allowed the group to continue in that area was actually the invention of desktop publishing software.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things that Doug Wilson explained, you know, when we're chatting to him about this, was that he realized that technological advances meant that anyone in any small town in North America had at their fingertips the ability to create text, and even eventually to circulate text, that they didn't need to be based in New York or Manhattan or wherever it may be. And of course then, you know, once they established Canon Press, which was the publishing arm of the Christchurch community, that I think was what allowed them to begin really to push forward the circulation of some of their ideas. Now, I mentioned earlier on at the very start of the conversation, Credenda Agenda in the 1990s. Like lots of other people who like free things, I subscribe to that because it was completely free.
Yeah.
And they were sending out copies all over the world. They're sending one to me, you know, in Scotland and in Northern Ireland. I was getting these copies of this. And in fact, in the late 1990s, Credenda Agenda had 22,000 subscribers. Now, that's a lot of magazines to get published and circulated.
Yeah,
that costs a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was, I suppose, the strategic decision to remain in Moscow, to build a community in a small town where they really did begin to make a bit of an impact in the local area. It was that decision, I think, which was made possible by desktop publishing software and other technological achievements that allowed the group to grow as it did.
No, that's exactly, you already hit on something that I was thoroughly interested to follow up in after reading the book, and it is the self-consciousness or the strategic, you know, thinking involved. And I wondered how self-conscious they were in terms of their marketing and specifically their publishing efforts, because what we find in this broad community of Christian Reconstruction, there's so many prolific authors, like seriously prolific authors, anywhere from Rush Dooney and just his reading and writing habits just make my head hurt. I wish I could think and write as much as he does, or Gary North, for example. But they read and write so much. I was curious. You know, nowadays you look back and you wonder, well, you know, this is a content marketing strategy. Are they self-aware of doing these like influencer marketing, or are they just pursuing their passion? Or perhaps is it just a combination of the two, whether they're intelligent and wise about what they're doing, but at the same time, they're so prolific just because they're thinking and writing about what they're passionate about.
Yeah. Interesting question, Camden. Really interesting. I mean, I think you're right. They are as a group, smart people. Or certainly they are led by smart people, mm-hmm. intelligent people, people who know how to communicate, who know how to communicate well, people who know when controversy is actually a useful tool, people who are not scared of controversy, and so on. Now, I mean, I think when you look back to the 1990s and Credenda Agenda, it has the feel of a Calvinist version of Private Eye, which is a satirical magazine in the UK. I don't know what the equivalent is in the US, but you know, it's got that kind of tongue-in-cheek witticism. Yeah. It's cheeky. It's a little bit avant-garde, but it's also thoughtful and reflective. You know, and it's really arguing for a preterist interpretation of Revelation in a regular column. You know, so it's doing lots of different things. And, you know, if you start reading some of the letters pages, they're kind of hilarious. There's Anabaptists writing in. There's people who are Eastern Orthodox writing in. One of my favourite letters, I think, comes from a Saturday Sabbath Baptist. It's like a collection of the weird and wonderful, which, you know, maybe makes me realise why I felt I was reading something that was kind of stimulating and bizarre sometimes, but also, you know, interesting,
sure,
in fun ways. But so, you know, all of this is happening. But fast forward to 2020, 25 years later, and you've got, I mean, if you visit Doug Wilson's website, it's very, very knowing. I think it's self-conscious, and I think that there's a branding exercise going on there. I think Doug Wilson recognizes that in some ways the brand has been built around him. And, you know, bear in mind now that, you know, that community is full of incredibly creative people, artists, filmmakers, musicians. And, you know, when it comes to making a good quality product, they really know how to do it. They really know how to do it. And, you know, if you look at the Amazon Prime talk show that Doug Wilson hosts at the moment, called Man Rampant, mm-hmm. I've only watched a couple of episodes, but, you know, again, it's built around him and a small number of other leaders of that community. But it's also very professional in its production, in the way it's presented and so on. But it's not, it doesn't take a softly, softly approach. And, you know, some of the, I think that the kind of humour that marked some of the earlier literary productions in this community, that seems to have gone. It's much more earnest. It's much, much more, I think, in your face, you know, it's much more direct. And I think that probably in some respects reflects both the maturing of this community, as well as the increasing increasingly dangerous situation in which they find themselves. Mm-hmm. So it's become a lot more urgent, a lot more direct, but at the same time, you know, along the way they have, as you say, they have moved from writing with Canon Press to writing with major, major imprints.
Right.
And, you know, they've collected co-authors of the likes of Christopher Hitchens. You know, this is not an obscure group. It might be small in number, but it really has put a huge amount of effort into extensive cultural reach, which is pulling people. You know, it's generating an international audience much, much more effectively than sending out 22,000 copies of a physical magazine to people like me who are, you know, who'd refuse to pay for it, but are happy to get something for free.
Sure.
So this is something which is commodified, if I can use a Marxist term, on Crisis Center.
It's a real
commodification of this theology. You know, I think there are marketing strategies. It's very savvy. It's very knowing. It's very intelligent. And as I say, the content is produced by smart people. You might not like what they write. Lots of people don't. Lots of Christians don't. A huge number of local people who are not Christians don't. Mm. But nevertheless, you know, they know what they're doing, and they seem to be doing it very effectively.
And in the community, I understand the risk maybe even of saying that, the community, because from the outside, we might think that, you know, there's this tightly defined group and you have a membership card or not. It doesn't work that way. Nevertheless, people within this community have transcended even not just the Canon Press and their own self-publishing. It's not really self-publishing, but their internal publishing efforts, not just to get outside of that, but also have transcended the genre, so to speak. They're doing videos as well, but this isn't merely didactic prose, as you say in the book, but have really expanded into all sorts of other forms of cultural production and art.
Exactly. Poetry, fiction. N.D. Wilson, Nate Wilson is Doug Wilson's son.
Right.
You know, he's been extremely successful as a children's author. And in fact, his Hello Ninja character has got a number of series now on Netflix as well. So yeah, you're right. I mean, I think what's really interesting is some of their material is very, very direct. The theological material takes no prisoners. But the imaginative material, the more creative material, is very subtle. You know, and it's doing a different kind of thing. It performs a different function within the ecology of disseminating ideas or just, I mean, in some respects, you could see the very didactic theological material as directly related to recruiting new members or at least disseminating key ideas, whereas the creative material is working at a much more subtle level.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to be building implicitly, very quietly, very subtly, building a Christian worldview without ever saying that's what it's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, when you read N.D. Wilson's work, you've really got to pay attention to see what allusions he's making, whether it's to scripture or to, you know, Mark Twain or to you know, classical authors or whatever. But if you can get tuned into that and pay attention to that, you can see that he is working to talk about, you know, the intermediate state, or indeed to think about the crisis of fatherlessness, or some of these other, you know, really big, wide-ranging cultural themes. So yeah, there's a huge amount going on, And I think now with the establishment of a music conservatory, I think that will obviously take didacticism in a completely different direction, because there, what's being produced is excellence in culture. It's not art for art's sake, but it is excellence in culture,
mm-hmm.
but in a non-verbal mode, in the mode of music.
Yeah,
I'd love to hear you speak, Dr. Gribben, about how this culture building, this culture warfare, relates to the post-millennialism of Reconstructionists, whether in the Moscow community or Rush Dooney. And perhaps you might draw from your own interests in Puritanism and also in Darby and dispensationalism. Would you tell us a bit about how the post-millennialism of Reconstruction, how it situates within the larger historical framework of American Puritanism and post-millennials like John Winthrop or Jonathan Edwards, and then how it comes to really an antithesis, a huge contrast with dispensationalism?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, Ryan. One of the questions I had when I was, you know, speaking to these people and writing about these people was, how important was postmillennialism actually? And is postmillennialism a necessary part of this system? Does it depend on postmillennialism to work? And, you know, I mean, I asked Doug Wilson that question in more or less as many words. And his answer was simply that it's easier to win if you believe you're on the winning side, which I suppose is true. Of course, all Christians, no matter what their eschatological position, believe they are ultimately on the winning side. It's not that amillennialists, if there are any amillennialists out there, I don't know if any exist anymore. But
that's what they said about postmillennials, 50 years ago, right?
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. Could you be a premillennialist and also a Reconstructionist? Mm. Well, in a way, I think the answer to that is yes, because James Wesley Rawls, who's the other big writer that I talk about in the book, is self-identified as a Reformed Baptist, but who also seems to be an historic premillennialist, not a dispensational, pre-tribulational premillennialist, but a historic post-tribulational premillennialist. So, you know, he has that, James Wesley Rawls has that view of the future, that yes, there's about to be an impending crisis that Christians must be prepared to resist and hopefully survive. But that crisis may not be the tribulation, but an actual tribulation is coming in which there will be, you know, massive destruction of Christians and Christian influence in society, which will then be followed by the millennium. So, you know, he doesn't present himself necessarily as a reconstructionist, but he does he includes Gary North in the acknowledgements of several of his books. He describes himself really as a libertarian, but he also says that the best government will be based on the Ten Commandments. So there's a kind of a tension there, an ambiguity there. But I think it's fair to call him a reconstructionist, who's also a premillennialist. Where does postmillennialism fit into the long history of millennialism in America? Well, I mean, you mentioned John Winthrop, it's always been there. You mentioned Jonathan Edwards. Edwards really believes the millennium is beginning in the Great Awakening of the 1730s and 1740s. It's curious to think what Edwards would say if he was dropped into Moscow, Idaho. What would he make of this? You know, and I think if he also told him, by the way, Kanye West just became a believer, I think he'd be pretty excited, actually.
That's one way to put it. Well, we should speak with our buddy Jeff Waddington somewhat about that. We long, long time ago done some episodes commenting on Edwards' proclivity for reading the paper, you know, even through his post-millennialism interpretive grid. Dr. Gribben, we can go all day. We won't keep you all day. Perhaps again, we can speak in the future, but I do want to at least finish on a point connecting this back to some recent literature that was very popular, at least here in the States a couple of years ago. And I'm just taking a quote here, an excerpt from the end here, your conclusion. You write, McIntyre, as in Alistair McIntyre, concluded After Virtue with hope for a new Saint Benedict. But other theorists, also developing their programs of renewal in the 1970s, were doing more to challenge dominant narratives and to inspire the creation of sustainable communities of survival, resistance, and reconstruction. Perhaps in the person of Rush Dooney, the evangelical Saint Benedict had already arrived. Could you comment, elaborate on that comment? I thought that was a remarkable paragraph.
Well, yeah, what does it mean? That's a really good question. Alistair McIntyre, back in After Virtue, had argued that American culture was increasingly divided between competing moral communities. So there was no, and I mean, I think that, you know, the last couple of decades has really borne this out, that Americans are divided into moral subsections, if you like, moral communities, and they find it very hard to speak over the border into the next moral community, assuming that there's any kind of shared definition for what is good or what is bad. And McIntyre, at the end of his book, After Ethics, is arguing that one Christian path through the crisis that he anticipated, you know, crisis is a big theme, but the crisis that he anticipated in American culture would be for Christians to begin to strategically withdraw to nurture their own communities, to nurture their own families within the faith, and to live separately, to live in an almost Benedictine way within a wider society. So, you know, I was reading obviously Rod Dreher's Benedict Option book, and, you know, trying to keep up to date with some of the things that he was saying, which seemed to sort of riff off McIntyre in different kinds of ways. And I suppose it just struck me that, you know, this was what Rush Dooney had been trying to do. And of course, this idea of strategic migration, building concentrations of strength and influence with a view to enduring an imminent crisis and working to achieve something greater in the far side of that crisis, that, you know, that's not only at the heart of the Rush Dooney enterprise, that's also at the heart of the Moscow, Idaho enterprise as well. I think I said before earlier on in our conversation that I think we can see Rush Dooney as a kind of a prophet figure. I think he is. I think he is farsighted. I think he can see the direction of Western culture. He is using Van Tillian tools, not just to analyze what the problem is, but also to think about what solutions might be. I think he tries to craft solutions. I don't think his solutions are desperately successful, but it's not the Reconstructionist 2.0 that take that forward. It's the Reconstructionist 0.5 who take that forward, who bolt rush Dooney's ideas into this much more ambitious cultural as well as social and political agenda. And, you know, it's now the second generation, perhaps even third generation heirs of Rush Dooney who are communicating these very ideas on platforms like Netflix, Amazon Prime, through publishers like Oxford University Press, Penguin, Random House, Simon Schuster, all the big publication, all the big publisher names. So, you know, Rush Dooney came, he didn't see, he didn't conquer, but he perceived what the direction of the culture was going to be, I think. And I think bequeathed the tools of analysis and also the ambition, not only to survive and reconstruct, but to rebuild in the far side, to individuals like Doug Wilson and others in the Moscow, Idaho community, who I think have been able to do far more with those insights and ideas than Rush Dooney or that first generation of Reconstructionists were able to achieve.
Yeah, I found this history thoroughly compelling. I didn't want to stop reading and studying it. I'm tremendously thankful for this book, for its existence. We've covered a lot of ground, but people need to read the book. So I encourage people to pick up a copy of this. I think it was only $29 from or thereabouts from OUP. So it's definitely affordable, from at least on an Oxford scale.
Not $175 or the prices for the handbooks.
Yeah. No,
but they're all excellent.
Well, they're top notch. Yeah. This is one of the world's great publishers. But of course, Survival and Resistance in Evangelical America: Christian Reconstruction in the Pacific Northwest, published by Oxford University Press and written by our guest today, Dr. Crawford Gribben. Crawford, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us across the pond. It's been a pleasure, and we need to, one way or the other, next time you're in the States, you come over to the Midwest, or we need to find some grant writing foundation to fund Ryan and I to come visit you.
There we go.
Beautiful. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Dr. Gribben. It's been a pleasure.
It's been our pleasure. I do want to point people to the various websites and all, and we'll have links in the episode description to the various resources we've discussed, as well as if you want to read up on Dr. Gribben and his CV. And we're online at reformedforum.org. There you'll find information about all of our programs, online courses, publications, all that sort of thing. We're not a Canon Press, but we're slowly getting there. From our distinct pilgrim mentality, our Vossian and Vantillian bent, which we are unashamed and hopefully would write as if we're taking no prisoners as well. But I do want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.